Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM radio programme about transport and design. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. We are chatting art, transport, communications, history. That's CATCH, it's the Catchcast. In this edition, we're discussing a subject that's rarely been covered, the experiences of LGBTQIA plus people in and around the railways, and how someone you know could help preserving that history thanks to a new National Railway Museum project. Today's guest is the curator of that pioneering project. Welcome to the Catchcast, Aisling Hudson-Welburn.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. Absolute pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you for being here, Aisling. I know how busy you must be getting this underway. And we're going to discuss this fascinating oral history project and how people can get involved. But I wonder if we can start by taking you right back to your interest in railways and transport. Were you fascinated by it all when you were younger?
Oh, I mean, find me a child that does not enjoy visiting heritage railways and watching the steam trains and things. Like, good luck with that challenge. Like, who isn't really when they're young? But yeah, I mean, my interest in railways and things actually grew out of an interest in freight logistics. And I'm a very nerdy person, if that doesn't come across. So,
freight logistics are definitely super nerdy. Well done.
So, I know, to be honest, that didn't start with a recent history either. So I developed an interest back when I was an undergraduate student in the development of trade routes and economics of maritime and overland trade, well, in the Neolithic and right the way through to like Viking age. And so it just became the subject that I just found really fascinating about the movement of people and goods and how like cultural influence could occur through trade, as well as, you know, the economics of it. And well, followed that for a few years. And upon graduation, with, you know, a museum sitting here on my doorstep, that's entire focus is one of the great transport industry components. Like, it just all kind of fit together. And, you know, as I say, as a young kid, like, yeah, of course I liked trains. Who didn't?
A very, very good choice, I would say. And your studies then, was this at the University of York?
Yeah, it was. So this isn't going to come across in my accent whatsoever, but I'm actually half Canadian. I was born and raised mostly in Canada, but with an English family. And I was in this country when I was young at sort of key points where you're learning to talk and developing an accent, hence why my accent sounds very English. But I actually came to York for university straight over from finishing school in Canada.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I had wanted to study history and archaeology as a combined subject because I was absolutely obsessed with Time Team. It was one of those things that I could just watch all day and all night. I'd been obsessed with archaeology as a subject since I was in grade 5 in Canada when we studied Egyptology. And I was an absolute little nerd about it. Yeah, so I came to York to study that.
On your doorstep, you found one of the most important national museums in the country.
I did.
And I think, was it around about 2014 approximately you started working there, Aisling?
It was, yeah. I was doing my master's degree at the time. Yeah, I applied to get a job here front of house because, you know, it's a great institution. I've always loved the Railway Museum and the Science Museum Group and just thought, I've got capacity while studying. I would love to be working there. So yeah, I applied and luckily they had me.
And you did a stint front of house and I believe you became a curatorial assistant in 2017. What does that involve?
Yeah, there's a couple things that can involve. For me, what that looked like was I was attached to the archive side of our curatorial department. So I would get to spend lots of time down in the storerooms. So I don't know if any of your listeners will have seen an archive before, but like picture really high shelving with like roller racking running along rails and just tons and tons and tons of boxes stacked to the ceiling on these rolling shelves and just loads and loads and loads of rooms full of things like that. So I spent a lot of time in those kind of spaces, finding stuff for people's research, public as well as staff who want to research things to do with the railways. They'd reach out to us. We'd discuss their interests with them. We'd think about what we actually have in the archives that might be able to assist their research. And then, you know, we'd arrange for them to come in and we'd go down and we'd get the stuff out for them. It does take many hours to get stuff out for one person when you think of the way things come into collections. Like, we have here 200 tons, roughly, of archive material. That's excluding the digital.
Oh, my goodness.
Imagine all the collections that we have, all the different formats produced by so many different companies, so many different individuals, some of them with really great finding aids that let you find the thing you're exactly after, some of which have slightly less good ones, and some of which don't have like any finding aids at all. And so, you know, it can be a real mix, because like, I think a lot of people envisage as like, you know, oh, someone asks for something, we'll type it into the database and then it'll tell us what we have and where it is and we'll go get it out. But it's not like that at all. Mm. We will go through what collections we have on that subject. It'll quite often be original paper lists and databases, if you will, in the archive themselves. And you're often going through these to actually find what it is that people want to look at. And then you're having to go through boxes and rolls of stuff and try and find the actual documents people mean. And even with the best catalogued collections, it's quite an endeavor to get stuff out for people. It's like, if someone asks for 9 objects, that's going to be like half a day of getting stuff out for them for a lot of things.
And I remember I've been to the National Railway Museum in York to do research and probably needed someone as helpful as yourself to try and find things. And I remember someone telling me that in those storerooms, you've got loads of stuff that's not even catalogued, so you just have to kind of instinctively know where everything is. Is it the photographs?
I believe it's about 3 million photographs at the moment, and they're in all formats as well. Most of them are not digital, those collections. We've got glass plate negatives, film negatives, pretty much ever existed, we have it. And the finding aids for those, they're just what the photographer has produced. Sometimes, like, we've got official collections from companies like, you know, LNER and things, who produce really nice detailed lists of what they had and numbered their photographs really tidily, because, you know, they were using it for their company, for publicity, for all sorts of marketing. Great, really helpful from a point of, you know, researching the collection, because it needed to be. But a lot of these old photography collections, they're passion projects from people back in the day. And so quite often they're not quite so well documented or structured. And sometimes you look at something, go, that's a picture of a whatever train, and I don't know where it is. I know nothing about it, know nothing about when it's taken. So, you know, there's a lot of work that could be done on photography to really make those collections more accessible. But it's an ever ongoing thing. It's like, they're just one tiny part of our collection. We have so many different types of material. One of our most popular is actually technical plans, like all the old BR works, all the carriage and wagon works, all the locomotive works. Like, we got the plans from them and they received, you know, all their drawings and technical plans from the companies that were nationalized into BR, and many of them had, you know, all the plans from the companies that formed them, because companies and rail were often merging and evolving all the time, changing name. It's one of those crazy little detective puzzles you get. If somebody ever asks you for a drawing in the archive, you have to be like, okay, like, if it's not a BR drawing, what company is this for? Okay, now, who took them over? Okay, who took them over? Okay, who took them over? And eventually you find out which part of the industry that record may have come in. And then you'll be like, so which BR works would have held that? And then we'll go find it in that collection. You can imagine, it's crikey. It can be such a task. It's real detective work.
Wow. There we go. Ashlyn the detective. All museums get dusty and dust mites and other pests. But Ashlyn, you got yourselves involved in a project to help protect the artifacts from being eaten and attacked. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there are two main threats you will get to any sort of museum collection, whether that's archives or objects. And those are mold and pests. And when I say pests, I mean, like, especially for archives, you're thinking small insects that really love to eat the proteins in a lot of the historical glues that bind things together. Some of them that like to munch on paper. And basically, in both of those respects, the things that you would do to prevent mold and pests are quite similar. And so I got involved with developing the strategies and regimens that all these activities are happening on, and making sure that you know what to monitor and what to change depending what you find. So
Brilliant.
It's a really integrated way of caring for your collections. It's preventative conservation.
Brilliant. Now, I think you were involved in a project called Open for All. Can you tell us a bit about that, please?
Yeah. So I'm guessing none of your listeners are going to be particularly familiar with, you know, the governance structures of the Science Museum Group. But Open for All, it's one of our five strategic pillars as an organization. Basically, it can be interpreted as the fact that we want our museums to be inclusive and accessible to everyone, no matter their background or community or identity. We want people to feel safe coming to our institutions, engaging with us, learning from the stuff we have here, and to build relationships with all those different people and communities. That goes both for external facing and internally. And so this is something which it wasn't a part of the organizational strategy or governance, but in 2019, it was the lovely Sarita Godber, People and Culture Manager. And it was a wonderful project. It was really her brainchild. And she sat all of the senior executive down, along with myself and three other people that she picked from across the organization who were engaged in inclusion-focused work. And we basically, from scratch, originally breaking into small groups with, you know, your poster paper and your markers, working out exactly how we could both figure out what the barriers to inclusion were in the organization, how we map and understand the problems and opportunities, and how we develop a strategy and actually embed this in not just governance, but make sure that we can do it in a way that actually tangibly changes things and impacts the way people work and what they do. So it was a really, really fun project working with the exec on that. And we drafted the strategy. If you ever want to know more about it, you can Google, read a bit about that. And, you know, it's played a really pivotal role in how we go about designing projects, designing work at the museum, and also how we streamline the approvals process as well for this type of work. Because one of the things that happens in a large institution, of course, is you have a lot of governance that is required and a lot of different systems and frameworks. And of course, that can create barriers sometimes to trying to get inclusive focused projects across and get them approved at the right level and things, get the wheels rolling. So it really was about redesigning the entire structure for how we approach this work as well. So from an evidence-based perspective all the way through to the delivery of projects.
Wow, very good. And did Open for All lead you into the understanding of a need for addressing gaps in LGBTQIA plus archival records within the UK rail sector, or was it something that you knew about already?
Yeah, it was the other way around. So this was 2018. Myself and another colleague in the curatorial team, who was also part of the LGBTQIA plus community, we were researching our collection to see what we could find out about our community's history within rail. And it was also because some of the train operating companies and things around LGBT History Month and Pride, like they'd been reaching out being like, do you have any stories or people that we can talk about, that we can celebrate, any history to share, like names we can put on our trains and things? And it's like, we really wanted to actually understand this, both for our own reasons and to help all these colleagues across the industry in our community. And so we dove into the archives and we kind of knew what we were going to find, which was that we weren't going to really find anything, but you do it anyway. And then you face the disappointment of not really finding anything. But it was important that we check, because that's how you get the wheels rolling with something like that, to see what your starting point is.
Yeah, you've got to know where you're starting, haven't you, really?
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those unfortunate things for the LGBTQIA plus community. Like for any community that you think of pretty much, identity-driven, geographical or whatever, there's usually going to be personal records, you know, diaries, letters, things that let you understand that community. And when they're in an archive or a museum setting, something that will allow that community to have its own voice, something that lets us as curators give that community its own voice, this ability to speak for itself. You get to the LGBTQIA plus community and we don't have that, because I mean, there are a handful of archives out there, but they're few and far between. It was often really dangerous for people to write down anything that particularly touched on anything to do with their relationships or identity in that respect in the past. So people didn't write it down. If they did, records are often being destroyed or edited after people died. Nowhere was actually collecting actively this stuff if you go back far enough. Like, so there's all these barriers because people could hide it, and often it was essential that they did for their protection and the protection of the people they knew. So they did. But that means what we have when we look at the collections today in the archives is we just have this absence. You look at the tapestry of railway history and it's just this big gap where LGBTQIA plus people and community should be.
And so was that the inspiration for setting up your project then, People, Pride and Progress?
It was, yeah, it was that. It's very much a passion project of mine because, you know, that reality that all we have for the most part is, you know, outside records looking in, things like police records that tell you a bit about some types of activity from a certain perspective. Like, it's not great when, like, that's like the bulk of what you have. Like, it means we can't really include LGBTQIA plus stories and voices within, you know, outputs in the museum, within exhibitions. And it also means that for people in the future, for future members of our community, if they ever want to deeply understand what the LGBTQIA plus experience in the industry has been like, they won't be able to. They're not going to have access to that, all the different types of experiences and what it looked like today. So it was really important to me that we go about doing something to improve this situation.
And so you set up this project. Can you tell us how you're going to do it? I believe it's an oral history project and you're trying to get around about 70, I think it is, interviews to begin with. I mean, how is it going to work? How are LGBT people going to be able to speak their history to you?
Yeah, so oral history, it is a wonderful tool. One of the things, basically, with LGBTQIA plus history, for all the reasons I've just said, like, it is only for the most part, sorry, for all the reasons I just said, like, it's mostly now preserved just in the memories of the people who lived it. So when we think about trying to improve what we have in the records, like, oral history is a really useful tool when it comes to capturing memory and transferring it into a format that can be preserved, can be researched. And so it was the first thing that I thought about was, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could sit down with lots of people from across the community, across different parts of the rail industry, different parts of the country working in rail, you know, different time periods, and just chat through their experiences and get that recorded. So it's really quite a straightforward, simple thing to do in oral history. It is kind of like this, you know, it's a one-to-one chat. We sit down with a recorder between us, a Zoom handy recorder, and we, you know, start at someone's early life, discussing, you know, what it was like growing up, where they're from, their relationships with family, friends, the ambitions they had, their interests, and transitioning into the adult world, the world of work, you know, what they did, how that affected, you know, friendships, family, how they felt about these transitions, what led them into rail, what they did there, their relationship with colleagues. You know, it's very holistic. It's a connecting the personal and the professional and trying to see how they impact each other and how they interact. And to get this full picture of a person, because, like, you have to think, when we record these stories, that person is forever going to be the lens through which these stories, through which that history is going to be understood. Yeah. So the more you understand that person, the more people in the future will be able to understand the things that they're telling them. So we don't just go into a room with pre-planned questions and be like, tell me about X, tell me about this in terms of your career in the industry or this. It's their story. It's, you know, that person's chance to tell their story. And so it's, you can think of it like a verbal memoir.
Beautiful. I love that expression, the verbal memoir. I heard you use it in the interview you did with Gareth Dennis. Ashley, you've already recorded scores of stories from LGBTQIA plus people working for or involved with the industry in some way. Can you give us a few of those experiences that have stood out for you?
Yeah, so, oh goodness, we've collected quite a few already. We're over 50 now. It's well on our way to the target we set out of 70, and I think we'll probably actually surpass it. We have heard so many different types of experiences, you know, the positive experiences, real moments of allyship people have had in the office where people have, you know, stood up for members of the community, real moments of community where people have told us about the ways in which they found other LGBTQIA plus folks, the wonderful shenanigans that they'd get up to, both, you know, when working together on the platforms, all the subtle phrases and ways they'd communicate about things with each other and, you know, their social lives. And we've heard some really tragic moments too, where people have talked about some horrible things that they've had to experience. Like in one instance, really sad one we heard of a trans woman telling us about how her managers at the time literally tried to stop her from being able to even go out into the town centre or out to a shopping centre just because they were afraid that people would learn that there was a trans woman working on their part of the railway industry if they saw her. And so there's some really horrible stuff, but there's also some really beautiful moments. And in one instance, we had two people where we realised they were telling the same stories and telling it from different perspectives down at like the travel centre in St. Pancras before Eurostar. And that was a fun one because it meant we were even able to reconnect old colleagues who hadn't seen each other in like over 20 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so one of my favourites that we have heard about as well was we had someone talking about how they were one of the last people, you know, to enter the industry before it became really apprenticeship focused, and how it was recommendations from another member of the community who led her to join. And she was a gay woman who ended up joining down south and working on this like all gay team where all three of the people working on the signal maintenance side were all gay. And, you know, it just sounded like an absolute dream for that woman and her introduction to rail. And she's still there quite a while later because it really made an impression, really made her love the industry.
Goodness, how amazing to have had colleagues all around you like that. That must have been really good. I know a ton of your work is about people's memories, but can we talk about the Pink Express, that special excursion train hired to run from London to Manchester in February 1988? I wasn't on it either, but I did go to the demonstration. It was part of the, because I'm so old, it was part of the campaign against Section 28, Never Going Underground, and a whole group of lesbian and gay people hired a train to run from the capital up to the north just because they could. And it was, I think, probably the first time that a group of gay people had ever hired an entire train. But I love the fact they called it the Pink Express.
Oh, it's a beautiful name. We love to call things the pink this or the pink that, don't we? I know, on the London Underground, have you ever come across the expression pink depots?
No.
That's a fun one. After partial legalization of same-sex activity between men in 1967, you started to get in some depots some people coming out, and of course that became part of the banter of the underground. Like people would talk about, oh, in that depot there's one of them, and that would mean other people in the community would be like, oh, if I go over there there'll be people like me. And so then you'd get all these little hotspots in the, like places like Parsons Green and Golders Green, where it's like loads and loads of people in the community and then allies who are comfortable with them. These wonderful little locations that were called pink depots.
Wow, I didn't know about that. That's a brilliant story. And what about some other things that came up when you were doing your interviews? It must have been particularly difficult, I imagine, for some of the more senior people you've spoken to who were perhaps around before everything was decriminalised.
Yeah, so we've not managed to interview too many people who were, you know, adults in that period before 1967. We've only interviewed a handful of people of that demographic. I know one of them in particular, their stories are really rough listening to. Literally, the man who developed the brake system for the HST, the Intercity 125, the brake system that actually allowed it to travel at the speeds it did and still stop within signal distances. So it's, you know, an innovation which saved our railways, basically. And he was a gay man who heard about the fact there were people like him in the world by hearing on the radio about the prosecution of Alan Turing.
Mm.
And, you know, that's rough to think that someone's first introduction to, oh, I'm not an oddball, I'm not the only one like me in my little rural location. I'm hearing about this famous person who, you know, the father of modern computing, but really tragically, the way his life was destroyed by homophobia. But yeah, so there are things like that in this collection. Then hearing about the ways that that kind of homophobia banter actually did exist in people's everyday lives, both in the workplace, the jokes people would make, the horrible inappropriate comments at the pub afterwards and things. Hearing like that guy speaking, you know, he talks about the fact he really was afraid of his colleagues learning that he was, you know, part of the community because the way they would remark the derogatory jokes.
Definitely does have a sort of reputation of being, to use a probably quite outdated phrase, a bit of a slightly sort of macho industry, particularly in things like engineering. But there must have been lesbian and gay people, transsexual people who worked in all of these parts of the railways and played an incredibly important part, like your brake development person. And those stories really do have to come out, don't they? We really need to find those people.
We do. I mean, those stories are really important, especially when you consider the museum's perspective. Like, we're a museum. We tell stories. We preserve things for the future. Why do we do that? We do it to inspire people so people can learn about not just the industry, but people like them, so that they can see themselves reflected within the industry and within career paths that they maybe themselves will one day take or that they have an interest in. Like, it's really important that people can see people like them in these positions. Role models aren't just celebrities, you know. Role models are the people you see every day in your life and the people you see, you know, talked about in an article or in a museum exhibition. So having these kind of stories, being able to talk about what ordinary people in our community have done, what they've achieved, has great value for people's sense of belonging and their ability to be them full selves.
Absolutely. It's so important, the work that you're doing. If anyone listening has experience of working in and around railways or knows of an LGBTQIA plus person who might like to contribute, what can they do? How do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so we're recording stories right through to the end of June this year. The easiest way to reach out to us is to drop us an email. It's peopleprideprogress, all one word, no dots, no anything. So peopleprideprogress@railwaymuseum.org.uk. And, you know, if you're a part of the community working in any part of the rail industry, just drop me a line and I'm happy to have a chat with you about participating and what that entails. But as I say, it's quite a relaxed process, you know, quite informal, just you and a member of our volunteer team who will also be part of the community, just sitting down for a chat about your life and just recording it.
Amazing. We could probably go on chatting for ages about this. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with someone who really cares so deeply for the people's history of railways. Thank you so much for joining us today, Aislinn.
You are very welcome. It's been so good to be here.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to Aislinn as much as I have. You can email Aislinn at peopleprideprogress@railwaymuseum.org.uk. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art, transport, communications history. Please do join us then.